Next, Monitor invites you to Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air, and consists of Stuart Hensley, UPI, Peter Lissagor, Chicago Daily News, Marquis Child, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and Robert McCormick, NBC News. Now here is our moderator, Ned Brooks.
One of the crucial issues facing the United States and perhaps the world is whether to resume the testing of atomic weapons. Because of the importance of the issue and the return of our chief negotiator from Geneva, we are postponing the scheduled interview with Undersecretary of State Chester Bowles. Our guest today will be Ambassador Arthur H. Dean, who was called home last week when the conference on a permanent ban on the testing of atomic weapons became deadlocked. These negotiations with the Soviet Union began in October of 1958, after the United States had suspended atomic testing. The talks have not been broken off officially, although President Kennedy has accused the Russians of deliberately wrecking the conference. Ambassador Dean gained prominence as a diplomat in the negotiations with the Chinese communists in Korea. He was a law partner of the late Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, and he accompanied Mr. Dulles on some of his diplomatic travels. And now we're ready to start the questions. We'll begin with Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Ambassador, we've been talking this over with the Russians now for almost 3 years. Do we have any alternative at this point to resuming testing ourselves?
Well, the question of whether we should resume testing is a very complex scientific, military, political question. I'm sure that President Kennedy, who's been thinking about this matter a great deal, is getting the best military and scientific and political advice that he can on this question. It seems to me that if it be decided that we have to resume tests in our own military security interest, then we have to face the fact that it will be rather unpopular around the world, especially in areas like Japan, which is the only country which has actually experienced a nuclear test blast.
Well, let me put it another way around. Can we continue to sit there and negotiate while we have, in effect, ourselves a ban without the inspection that we demand the Russians do?
Well, I think we should keep the Geneva talks open. Under President Kennedy's guidance, for the first time in 2.5 years, we have drafted and we have tabled a complete text of a nuclear treaty ban on behalf of the United Kingdom and ourselves, and we're prepared to sign it, so that if the decision is that we should resume testing, and that's not my province, I still think we should continue to talk and then to say that if they'll sign the treaty, we'll stop testing.
Could I have just one more quick one, please, Mr. Ambassador? Do you think the Russians want an agreement?
As of the present time, I believe that because of what they think they're accomplishing in Laos and Cuba and on West Berlin and other parts of the world, I think they'd like to merge the nuclear test ban talks into general disarmament and then probably try to continue the present uninspected, uncontrolled moratorium on not testing until some future undefined date in the future.
Mr. Lissagor.
Ambassador Dean, how valid is the argument that the Russians might stand to gain more from a resumption of tests than the United States would?
Well, I can only tell you what our scientific advisors tell us on that. The conference started October 31, 58. That's the last time we tested in that month. The Russians carried on a series through November 58. In the so-called later, so-called tactical nuclear weapons, we have tested many, many more times than the Soviets have. And some of our scientists believe that we're very far ahead of them. And that if, on the other hand, we should decide to resume tests, you don't just do one test, you have to do a whole series of tests. It might be that after the end of 2 or 3 years that possibly they might have gained more than we have. That's a scientific matter on which I'm not competent.
But that scientific judgment, Mr. Ambassador, is based upon the presumption, is it not, that they have not been testing themselves. Now, did you get any hint or evidence at Geneva that they might, in fact, have been testing in secret?
As of the present time, it's possible by the so-called decoupling. Decoupling, in non-scientific language, means the interruption of the seismic waves that come from an earthquake or a nuclear explosion. It's possible to test underground and interrupt these seismic waves so that you can get a far greater yield, maybe 300 times as great, without its registering on what's called the seismic scale of magnitude. We have no evidence that they have tested. We have no evidence that they have not tested, but it is certainly possible that they might have tested underground through decoupling.
Some people say that we have enough in our nuclear arsenal now, Mr. Ambassador, to make testing unnecessary. How would you answer that kind of an argument?
Well, apart from the question of whether from a military or moral standpoint we should resume testing, I would think that in any scientific field you can always gain more knowledge by testing. There are those who believe that we could vastly decrease the weight and greatly increase the yield. There are those who believe that we could develop the fusion bomb, and there are those who believe that we could develop the neutron and the neutron flux, which may be very important in the anti-missile field.
Mr. Drummond.
Mr. Dean, you know very well, of course, that the Soviets really initiated the crusade several years ago to begin the negotiations to end testing. They're the ones that pressed for it above all others. They're the one that made the maximum propaganda about radioactive fallout. Is it your judgment now that the United States succeeded in resolving its own differences, resolving differences with its allies, and have laid a treaty on the table that you have demonstrated that the Soviets never had an intention?
I think the answer to that question is yes. With President Kennedy's great help, we resolved all of the differences here in Washington. We resolved our differences with the British, and we now have tabled a treaty which we are prepared to sign, and I think we've unmasked the Russians because they were making great propaganda that they wanted it. Now I think they've made it clear that they don't want it.
Well, you mentioned that it might be very unpopular to resume testing, and I think most of us have been of the view that over the years, that in many ways, at many points, the Soviets have gotten the better of the propaganda, have made themselves look as though they were eagerly seeking an agreement, while we might appear to be holding back. Do you think that we can successfully persuade the rest of the world now that we've genuinely sought a treaty and that resuming testing is something that's unavoidable under the circumstances, or may be unavoidable?
Well, I can only say that when I went to Geneva on March 21st, the editorials around the world were somewhat critical of the United States. As of today, almost overwhelmingly, editorials all over the world are very favorable to the position that the United States has taken. Now, whether if we decided to resume testing, we would continue to have that favorable impact, or whether some people would go against us even though we had to make the test, I don't know.
Mr. Hensley.
Mr. Ambassador, when you were asked why you thought Mr. Khrushchev and the Russians decided to merge the talks, throw the test ban into general disarmament, it seemed to me you were relating it to a general context of other factors, Berlin and so forth. Now, there have also been expressions of opinion in the government here that it's possible the Russians got the word from the Chinese that they would never join a ban. They noticed that the French continue testing, and I wonder if you think these factors might have entered into it at all.
They mentioned the French testing, but I have very good reason to believe that was not any factor in their thinking. I have heard the arguments that Mao Zedong, the Chinese premier, has demanded that Chairman Khrushchev not sign a nuclear test ban treaty. I have no knowledge on that. We don't demand that China sign it, but if Russia signs it, we have the right to insist that China come in, and if she doesn't come in, then we have the right to end the treaty.
Would you like to explain a little more clearly what you mean by saying that Khrushchev may have decided just to throw these into the disarmament talks and stall because of the way things are going for him in Berlin and Laos and so forth?
Well, I think he thinks that the communists are winning in Laos. I think he thinks that the communists are winning in Cuba. I think he thinks that he can create dissension between the NATO allies by taking a tough stand on West Berlin and trying to force our allies to agree with us on a tough military posture, which won't be popular.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, on the question of timing on the possible resumption of tests, I understand that's Mr. Kennedy's responsibility, but he said in his memorandum the other day to Mr. Khrushchev that in view of the ease of bootleg or clandestine testing without any ban, and also that with this ease, why each government will face the increasing necessity for its national security to start testing again. You put those two points in his aide memoir together, and it appears that something should be imminent. Is that correct?
I don't know. I'm very sure that President Kennedy will examine this question with the utmost care, and even if the decision to test were made tomorrow, it takes quite some time, you know, before tests can take place. Even then, you have to do a series of tests and then evaluate.
Mr. Ambassador, you mentioned Red China a moment ago. Is there any evidence that the Russians are helping Red China to develop atomic weapons?
A small evidence that we have is that they are not helping the Red Chinese and to develop nuclear power, and that is one of the sources of friction between the Red Chinese and the Russians today.
Do you think there's some fear on the part of the Russians that the Chinese will, through some other means, develop atomic weapons?
Well, our scientists believe that even without Russian help, that the Chinese, who are very brilliant mathematicians and physicists, can probably get a fissionable bomb by 62 or 63. Of course, you still have to develop a warhead to deliver.
Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Dean, aren't you sort of negotiating from behind the eight ball over there? Why should the Russians want a test ban when they have one now without any inspection, without having made any concessions at all? In other words, until we resume testing, we have no bargaining position, do we?
Well, the moratorium was announced by us in July of 58 and by the Russians in November 58. President Eisenhower announced on December 29, 1959, that we were no longer bound by the moratorium. We could resume testing at any time, but we would give notice when we decided to do it. So we're free to resume testing at any time. I think our biggest weapon was the fact that the Soviets did not want to see nuclear weapons proliferated, especially they did not want to see them in the hands of the Red Chinese. If you got the treaty, I think that India and all of the other countries would have signed it, and then perhaps we could have negotiated with France and with Red China on this subject.
Well, if the Russians do not want a treaty, and it seems fairly clear they don't, isn't that an indication that they are not cheating on us? If they are cheating, obviously they'd be making a lot of progress while we're doing nothing.
Well, all I can say is that we've examined very, very carefully in an effort to try to get evidence that they are testing. We can't find any evidence that they are, but then, of course, you can't prove the universal negative that they are not.
Mr. Lissagor.
Mr. Ambassador, if we're ahead, as scientific judgment now puts us, might not the Russians want to resume testing, but through the device of an impasse at Geneva, so that we would be forced to resume testing and therefore take the propaganda black eye and permit them to resume? Would you give any weight to that?
There is a school of thought that some of their scientists are urging Chairman Khrushchev to permit them to test some new weapons. And that the reason that they're stalling is that they want us to be the first to resume testing so that they can test. They also believe that we have more advanced techniques in testing underground without any danger of radioactive fallout, and that they would probably have to test in the atmosphere.
Now, does it follow then that if we were to resume testing, we would be playing their game?
That is one of the problems which President Kennedy must weigh in reaching his decision as to whether we should or should not resume tests.
I'd like to ask you another question in regard to the president's pledge during the campaign and perhaps later that he would prescribe a reasonable time limit to these negotiations before we would have to do what is right in our own national interest. Do you believe that if we fail to act in resumption of test after that pledge, and a reasonable time limit, I assume, has just about passed, that the communists might regard it as another lack of will to act on the American part, because a lack of will to act seems to figure in their calculations now on a lot of other fronts?
Well, I've been a student of communist thinking now for about 20 years and have done a lot of work on it with scholars very intensively. And the one thing I do not know is how the communists think or what influences them, and I would not wish to pose as an expert on that question. I think this is such a terrible decision. I mean, a thermonuclear blast of one certain number of megatons would destroy everything in an area of 10 by 40 square miles. And if a person with a normal reflex turned to look at the fireball of an H-bomb, he'd be blinded immediately. Now, a certain number of those... every testing increases the amount of radioactive material, and sooner or later it returns to the Earth, so that the underground, you can do it without radioactive fallout, but perhaps some of the tests might have to be done in the atmosphere. That's a scientific question. But I'm sure President Kennedy has got this very much in mind and is weighing the question very seriously.
Mr. Drummond.
Mr. Ambassador, in his opening remarks, Mr. Brooks described the negotiations as having reached a deadlock. What, in your judgment, is the heart of the deadlock at Geneva on this question?
Well, in order to prove that someone is not testing, you have to set up about 180 seismological control stations. Seismological is... can detect whether it's a natural earthquake or whether it's a nuclear explosion from the movements in the crust of the Earth. Then you have to have scientists at each one of these control stations. If there's an explosion on Russian territory, if they can't identify it immediately as an earthquake, and in an earthquake there's a movement in and a movement out, whereas nuclear there's only a movement out, you'd have to send an on-site inspection team in there to inspect. We want at least 12, one out of every unidentified explosion on Soviet territory. Assuming there's 60, we get 12. If there's 100, we get 20. But then the inspection teams have got to be captained on Soviet territory by an American or a Britisher. They want them captained by a Russian. They also don't want us in unless we can prove that the explosion took place in an area no larger than the District of Columbia. And you can't do that under the present science. And then we gave them on the Top Control Commission parity. That is, there are 4 West, 4 Soviets, and 3 neutrals. So a majority would be 6. They say even if you had 2 neutrals voting for an inspection, instead of having a single administrator to carry out the treaty as they previously agreed, you have to have 3, a Russian, a Westerner, and a neutral, and the one Soviet man can even veto and refuse to permit an on-site inspection, even though the 2 neutrals in the top commission voted for it.
Would it be oversimplifying it then to say that the Soviets are asking for a system of inspection which, in effect, on their territory, they could veto at any time? Or on any territory.
That they're asking for a system of inspection which they could veto and which would be completely useless.
May I ask whether I've heard it argued that even if we got the inspection system that we've laid out in the treaty, that it still would be very far from foolproof and that there would be deep risks. What is your answer to that question?
The inspection system we've laid out in the treaty for underground inspections yielding on the seismic scale of magnitude above 4.75 would work. In outer space, it would deter and make it very expensive and make them go out further and further. The treaty, as of the present time, will not apply to explosions below yielding below 4.75 because with the pounding of the waves or wind, you can't measure them. We've agreed to go for 3 years to carry out this moratorium for another 3-year period, to carry on a big seismic research program, to amend the Atomic Energy Act so that the Russians can examine the devices to be sure they're not weapons. And then if we can improve the treaty's detection capabilities to lower this treaty threshold below 4.75. But the answer to your question is, we are assured by our scientists and the British scientists that the treaty control system, if you get rid of this veto and get rid of this captaining of the inspection teams and the other limiting in space, that it will work.
Mr. Hensley.
Mr. Ambassador, whenever we get into discussion with the Russians on anything, it usually breaks down on any inspection or control which would require them to open up a bit in their territory. Mr. Khrushchev told Mr. Harriman and a succession of envoys that one of his biggest military weapons was secrecy. And he always asked why he should give this away when he knew what was happening in the United States. Having been told this over the year, weren't we a little naive to ever think that the Russians would accept any control system?
Well, this question of nuclear testing and this question of its effect upon health if it's done other than underground, I think, is the most important question confronting our civilization as of today. And I don't think there possibly can be too many efforts at trying to solve this problem with the Soviets. I'm very sure the problem is going to be solved, maybe not at this conference, but I'm sure it will be solved by some treaty organization.
Well, that reminds me to ask you a question which is rather out in space, but is it possible that the answer to this whole thing may eventually lie in the development of satellites and photographic techniques to the point where nothing that anybody does anywhere can be secret anymore anyway, and we will have inspection and control whether you like it or not?
Well, under the treaty control system that we tabled for outer space, it calls for 2 far Earth satellites and 3 solar satellites so that we can photograph beside the moon. Now, they still can, by shielding with lead shields on nuclear devices, absorb the heat to such an extent that they may not be able to register, but we think we can overcome that.
Mr. Ambassador, what's going to determine whether you go back to Geneva, and if you do go back, when will it be?
Well, if there's any possibility for fruitful negotiations, I will certainly return, because as I said, President Kennedy does not wish to leave any stone unturned in an effort to try to arrive at a workable nuclear test ban treaty. My deputy, Charles Stell, is a very able, very experienced Foreign Service officer. He will carry on the talks, and I will return at a moment's notice if it's deemed that that would be fruitful.
We have about a minute and a half. Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Ambassador, why do we object to including a nuclear test ban in the general disarmament talks, which are supposed to start next month?
Well, the general disarmament talks, in order to work out a complete program of disarmament, may take several years. And when President Kennedy was at Vienna, he asked Chairman Khrushchev that he pointed out the delay and our objections to continuing the uninspected moratorium. But then he said, assuming we agreed to it, would you put it the first item on the agenda? And Chairman Khrushchev replied, oh no, we wouldn't discuss it in the first stage.
Well, we're not making much progress where we are we?
Mr. Lissagor.
Mr. Ambassador, you've had about as wide an experience in dealing with the communists or negotiating with them as probably any American. I'd like to ask you the broad question of what does it take to get an agreement with them? Do you have to make damaging concessions in order to do so?
I don't think we've made any damaging concessions in this nuclear test ban treaty. I think we've been realistic about a good many matters on which we had not made up our minds. But I think it takes power, I think it's strength, and the patience of Job.
Mr. Drummond, short
question. Mr. Ambassador, from all your relationships with the Soviet negotiators, do you feel that the Soviets really are either hesitant or afraid to open up their society to a reasonable inspection,
Sorry, that's a fine question. We just ran out of time. I'm sorry to interrupt, but our time is up. Thank you very much, Ambassador Dean, for being with us.
Thank you, Ned Brooks. We'll return with the details about Meet the Press in just a moment.
Sightseeing this summer? Don't overlook some of the local color, the June tourist calendar lists, a puppeteers festival in California, a catfish derby in Oregon, a folk song fest in Kentucky, and horse shows and powerboat regattas in most of the 50 states. This is Merrill Muller suggesting that wherever you go, travel with radio and witness the pageant of world events on NBC. You'll be in touch with all important developments as they happen on NBC Radio News on the Hour.